Spectrum Business works with small businesses nationwide, so we know that running your own business means doing it all. Marketing, sales, inventory, customer service, and more. Spectrum One for Business helps you keep it all connected for just $49.99 a month. Get fast, reliable internet, advanced Wi-Fi with Security Shield, and a free mobile line for one low price. Stay connected and do it all with Spectrum One for Business. Only $49.99 a month. Go to spectrum.com/business to learn more. Restrictions apply. Services not available in all areas.
Hi, it's Stephen Colbert, and I'm here to tell you about The Late Show Pod Show, which is the podcast of The Late Show with me, Stephen Colbert, and I'm here with my producer of the podcast, Becca. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Stephen.
So what do people get when they listen to The Late Show Pod Show? Let's sell this thing.
The extended moments, for sure, because we run out of time for broadcast, but we have plenty of time on the podcast.
It's kind of like being a live audience member of the show because you get things that no one else hears. Listen to The Late Show Pod Show with Stephen Colbert wherever you get your podcasts.
Get the whole band together with Workday and pair finance and HR on one platform for an epic performance. With Workday AI at the core, you'll make confident decisions faster than ever. And you'll drive flawless business and finance operations with an agile platform that constantly evolves to future-proof your organization. Be a finance and HR rockstar with Workday. Visit Workday.com to learn more.
And so the lesson should be, how do you run candidates that are more broadly appealing? How do you adapt to a new system that incentivizes majority support? And that's lost, I think, in this battle, what is really just over political power.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. What if I told you that less than 10% of voters elect more than 80% of the U.S. House of Representatives? You might think it's all because of gerrymandering, but really a lot of it is because of how we hold our primary elections. The actual system we use for choosing candidates is pushing candidates to the extremes to get elected. What if we could change that? What if we could let more voters have a say in who gets to appear on the ballot in November? What if more people were actually excited to vote for a candidate instead of against someone else? Today, we're going to talk about how opening our primary elections could benefit voters, how it could reshape the way elected officials think about their jobs and what they're willing to vote for, and how we're already seeing it work in states like Alaska. So I'm excited to talk about all of this with Nick Troiano. Nick is the executive director of Unite America, an organization that supports party-neutral reforms that improve representation, increase accountability, and put voters first. Previously, he worked for Change.org and ran for Congress in Pennsylvania in 2014, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Nick and I know each other from the political reform space, and his work there, I think, has informed a lot of the insight in his new book, The Primary Solution: Rescuing Our Democracy from the Fringes. Nick, welcome to Politicology.
So great to be with you, Ron.
This is the sound of your engine getting clean. Because BP and Amoco gasolines with Invigorate clean deep in your engine as you drive, helping your car run better to take you farther. Fuel a cleaner engine with BP and Amoco gasolines with Invigorate at a station near you. Optimizes your engine's performance from the harmful effects of deposits caused by minimum detergent fuels. Requires continuous use. Results depend on what you drive and how you drive. Comparison made for fuels with the same ethanol content.
Yeah, you know you need protein to fuel results, but it's not easy when you're drinking the same bland, chalky shake every day. Stop punishing yourself and get to GNC for the best protein in the game, including all the hottest brands and crave-worthy flavors that'll keep you coming back for more. We're talking protein that legit tastes like cookies, your favorite cereals, indulgent desserts, and more. So bust out of your protein rut and actually look forward to those shakes with unbeatable protein at unbeatable prices. Fuel your fitness with protein at GNC. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Irish Spring Body Wash and Bar Soap. When it comes to your shower routine, Irish Spring knows that what matters most is feeling refreshed. It's crisp, fresh, unmistakable scent. Zings your brain, awakening your senses. So you emerge from the shower ready to take on the day and smell great while you're doing it. Irish Spring Body Wash and Bar Soap. Fresh, green, Irish. Shop now at Walmart.
So why don't we begin with a bit of personal history before we dive into the work. Take us back to the beginning. Why did you get involved in politics in the first place?
The real beginning was second grade student council, but I'll spare you that story. Okay. And say, actually, a formative experience early on in my life was attending the American Legion Boys State Program, the civics program where you go play government for a week and you realize what it means to be part of a community of people that are trying to leave that community better off than how you found it. And that inspired me. So I came to DC to study government and politics and soon found myself very active on the issue that I cared about most, which is the trajectory of our country's current fiscal situation. Now, that was 10 years and $20 trillion of debt ago, and the problem has gotten much worse. But really, it was a front row seat in seeing how divided and how dysfunctional our politics have become, and really called to try and do something about that.
This is a really great segue because we just recorded an episode yesterday zooming in on the debt, the monetary problem that we have. The listeners will already have listened to that last week by the time we air this. So can you tell the story in the book about where you were when Simpson-Bowles went down? What was Simpson-Bowles? What did that sort of episode do for you?
Well, originally, this is in 2012 or 13, I believe, there was a proposal to establish a commission in Congress to bring Democrats and Republicans together to study what can be done to close the growing gap in our budget that's driving our larger debt and deficits. Originally, that was going to be done through a congressional commission. In fact, Judd Gregg and Kent Conrad, a Republican and Democrat, were co-sponsors of it. And so the group that I helped start, which is called The Can Kicks Back, was a group of young people sick of politicians kicking the can down the road, went to the Capitol Hill. You know, we held a large banner with, you know, $10 trillion, $800 million, you know, dollars of debt to push for passage of that proposal. Well, what happened was within the last week or so, President Obama actually came out to say, this is a good idea and I support it. Well, what happened after that was Mitch McConnell and six Republican co-sponsors went from supporting that commission proposal to opposing it because it would have been seen as a win for the president, and the commission proposal failed. So instead, President Obama wound up establishing his own commission and recruited former Democratic White House Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles and former Republican Senator Al Simpson to co-chair it. And sure enough, that commission met over the course of some months and produced a plan that would put the country in a more sustainable path. And so our organization rallied behind that and tried to build support. And one of the ways that we did that was going across the country in a van with a giant tin can named American to college campuses, getting students to sign cans and bring them to Washington with a message. Well, we went to the campus of the University of Wyoming in that fall to do an event with Senator Simpson. And that was the day that the government shut down, because what was happening in Washington was they weren't trying to pass policy looking for the long-term, you know, fiscal interests of the country. They were having a giant fight. Ted Cruz was leading over defunding the president's healthcare bill. And so it was really at that moment, that was the second major moment that I had of going, I don't think we're ever going to be able to deal with these large long-term challenges, because it's not a policy problem. This is what I thought was a politician problem. And so I decided at that moment that I would do anything, you know, something really normal for a 25-year-old, which is to go back home and run for office as an independent.
Okay, so how did you zero in on primary elections as the problem?
Well, the problem that I thought was the next problem I was going to try and solve was the politician problem. I ran for office for a year as an independent, and I came away from that race, which I lost, realizing we actually have an incentives problem. And what I mean by that, I'll just take my district, for example. Yeah. In Pennsylvania, it was gerrymandered to be a safe Republican district. So no matter who the candidates were, Republican was going to win in November, which means the primary was the only election that mattered. And Pennsylvania is one of 15 states that has closed party primaries. So the 1.5 million independents in the state can't vote in either of those primaries. And to win a primary, you don't need to win a majority of votes. You just need to win a plurality more than any of your opponents. And so after the race, I was reflecting, I get it now. Why did my congressman vote for the government shutdown? He wasn't trying to represent a majority of constituents in the district. He was representing the 5% of voters who supported him in his first election, in which he won with just 48% of the vote. And that was a light bulb moment for me. And that informed the work going forward about, if we want to change the outcomes, we have to change the rules of the game and the incentives that they influence.
So as somebody who gerrymandered the districts in Nevada, or I would say redistricted Nevada back in 2011, I think I know half a dozen answers to this question, but why wasn't gerrymandering reform or political redistricting reform the immediate answer and not primary elections?
Well, when we launched United America, which is the organization I run now, which invests in nonpartisan election reform, we really have developed a policy portfolio of ending gerrymandering through independent redistricting, ensuring majority winners through instant runoffs, and opening primaries to all voters through open or nonpartisan primaries. The reason why we prioritize primary reform is even if you were to eliminate partisan gerrymandering in the country, the vast majority of congressional seats would remain uncompetitive or safe for one party or the other, because the way that we've geographically self-sorted, with more progressives living in more urban areas, more conservatives living in more rural areas, you'd have to actually gerrymander the districts to make them competitive. And so, yes, we should address gerrymandering, and that won't solve the problem until we solve the primary problem.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay, this is important as a baseline. We haven't always had primary elections because we haven't always had parties. Can you explain the history of primaries, how we developed them in the first place, how they got to be taxpayer-funded elections, and why George Washington warned us about having parties, political parties in the first place?
We're living it right, right now. You know, the alternate domination of one party over another, sharpened by the spirit of revenge, is what some founders called the greatest political evil to be dreaded under the Constitution. This was Washington, Adams, Jefferson, and so on. And despite that, of course, parties developed early on in the history of our republic. You can understand why. They are important organizing mechanisms for how we do politics. The challenge is, in the early days, how did those parties select their candidates? That was done through the old caucus and convention system. You've heard of the proverbial smoke-filled rooms where party bosses would sort of handpick the candidates. That's how it was done. There were no popular elections. That presented this problem of corruption because of the party machines and how they would reward those who got elected with, you know, jobs for the party and government and so on. And so by the time the progressive era rolled around in the early part of the 20th century, reformers said, we need to do away with the old party boss system and give voters a direct say. Tammany Hall is a, you know, well-known party machine in New York, and Boss Tweed, who led that, famously said, I don't care who gets to do the electing as long as I get to do the nominating. So it just goes to show, even back then, they knew the strings that they could pull in the nominating process was how they derived their power. So reformers sought to break that up. And in 1904, Wisconsin became the first state to institute a direct primary, which allowed all voters to participate in the nominating process. And within a decade, a majority of states followed suit.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until
the Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Now at Topgolf, you get half off golf Monday through Wednesday when you book in the app. It could be any Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday. Like this Monday, next Tuesday, and the following Wednesday. Or maybe this Wednesday, next Tuesday, and the Monday after that. Basically, any Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday is a good day, as long as you spend it at Topgolf. It's golf. It's half off. It's half off golf. Monday through Wednesday when you book in the app for a limited time only. So download the Topgolf app, book a bay, and come play around. Restrictions and exclusions may apply. Visit topgolf.com/halfoffgolf for details.
Is there such a thing as a traveler? Not a Delta. Because we know on one flight, Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. While on the flight after, 8C is occupied by Jen, whose favorite snack is tea. That's why we provide fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members. Because at Delta, we know.
Refill?
Everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing. Free Wi-Fi available on most domestic flights. Terms of use apply.
This is a really good... All right. From the time that I spent in the democracy reform space, political reform space, it became very clear very quickly that the two parties, which have a stranglehold on political power, they're basically a functioning monopoly, right? In that they don't allow new entrants into the system. What I didn't understand is the degree to which partisan primaries paid for and administered by states have gotten calcified into law. That both parties have, through statute, sort of enshrined themselves into this position of privilege, of power, such that it's very difficult to compete with them. I think you learned this at Unite America. You talk about it in the book, I think, that independent candidates can't win, by and large. Asterisk, right? Occasionally you get one or two, but as an operating rule in politics, independent candidates don't win. That's kind of by design, and by design of the two parties. So can you talk about how exactly what laws enable these parties to keep competition out? How is it that they maintain this stranglehold on power and do it with taxpayer funding?
In the old days, the elections were run by the government, but the parties had their own way of nominating their candidates separate from the government-run process. And in fact, when you went to vote, you would bring a ticket printed by the parties to drop in the ballot box on election day. And by the way, if you wanted to vote for some candidates of one party and some of another, you would literally split your ticket, staple it or tape it back together, and then deposit it, which is how split ticket voting came to be. Now, and there was no secret ballot. You know, when that changed and the government started to print the ballots is when it opened the door to the parties that were in power being able to regulate those same elections that they participated in. And that duopolistic behavior that you reference is a function of the fact that the parties control the government, which control our elections. So fast forward to today, what does that mean? They have outlawed fusion voting, right? Which used to be widespread across the country when minor parties could cross-nominate candidates from major parties. Many states passed anti-fusion laws because they were looking to limit competition. They passed so-called sore loser laws, which is for candidates who lose a party primary, saying you can't run as an independent and put your name on the general election ballot. They've passed campaign finance laws that allow party candidates to raise a lot more money into the party apparatus than, say, independents can. So you combine all of these things, that results in a system where you have 435 members of Congress, all Democrats and Republicans, despite the fact that we live in a country where 50% of Americans identify as independent. Today, the system is not representative of the voters because the party system really has entrenched its own power.
Yeah, and rising. We should note independent registrations are rising rapidly even now. Before we get too far, I thought it might be a good idea to define some of the terms we're going to use, just in case they're confusing. So, a closed primary, which is what you're probably most familiar with, is when only voters registered with a party can vote in that party's primary election. So if you're an unaffiliated or independent voter, you can't vote in a closed primary. An open primary is when voters of any party affiliation can vote in the primary of any party. A semi-closed primary is if you're registered with a party, you can vote in that party's primary. If you're an unaffiliated or independent voter, you can choose which party's primary to vote in, but only one of them. In all of these options, you can only vote for one party's primary. So if you want to vote for a candidate in the Republican presidential primary, but a Senate candidate in the Democratic primary on the same ballot, you can't. Multi-party primaries is when there's a single primary election where all of the candidates, no matter what party, are all on the same ballot. This is also called a jungle primary, and California and Alaska are both good examples. California has a top two system where the top two vote getters go on to the general election, and Alaska has a top four system where the top four primary vote getters go on to the general election. Okay, you talk about the closed party, primary system as a lose-lose-lose system. So who does it hurt, how, why, and who benefits from it?
In short, I make the argument in the book it's bad for voters in the sense that it really restricts who has access to the ballot. 15 states bar independents from voting. In another 15 states, if you're a Democrat in a red district or a Republican in a blue district, your vote in the primary really won't matter because you're only restricted to voting in your own party's primary. It's bad for voters in the sense that they don't get to cast a meaningful vote. Many voters don't. I argue that it's bad for the country because the result of that is it warps the incentive structure. We wind up electing people who are beholden to the fringe 8% on the left or right who are unable and unwilling to work with each other to solve problems. So things like immigration reform, for example, or the budget or climate, it's hard to craft sustainable bipartisan policy. And I make the argument somewhat counterintuitively that the current system is very bad for the political parties themselves. If you understand parties to be organizations that are trying to nominate competitive candidates, win majorities in legislatures, and then translate that power into policy victory, that's not happening right now. I mean, look what's happening in Congress, where three Republicans at this current moment are trying to, once again, dispose of the House Speaker, who's constrained by the narrowest majority of the most extreme members. They are products of the party primary system. Or you go into the other chamber and you realize Mitch McConnell is in the minority now because Republicans ran five candidates in 2022 in swing states that were all far outside the mainstream voter. It's not just a Republican problem. I read a lot about Kurt Schrader, a Blue Dog Democrat in Oregon, who was primary out of office in 2022 after working on the bipartisan infrastructure bill. The further left candidate who primaried him went on to lose the general election. Mm-hmm. And that was one of five seats Democrats needed to pick up the House. So this system is not a good tool for the parties to nominate candidates, in part because they've lost control. They've lost control to the party activists and to the, as you know, wide range of special interest groups for which primaries are a cheap date. They can spend a very little amount of money and really control the aperture of which people run for office and who gets elected.
Yeah. And part of the reason we should explain that it doesn't take, you know, enormous sums of money to have enormous influence is because there's a tiny fraction of people who are actually voting in these primaries, which means your advertising budget is small. It doesn't have to be massive to reach the, you know, critical mass of voters to sway the primary. And you can then dictate what happens to the leadership of that state with a tiny bit of campaigning.
Exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead. Okay. Okay. We just recorded an episode where double haters kept coming up. There's less and less enthusiasm for candidates, and general elections are now dominated by negative partisanship. We talk about this a lot, meaning that voters aren't voting for a candidate. They're voting against the one they view as the most intolerable. So how do partisan primaries contribute to the frustration that so many people have when they look at a general election ballot? And how do you see cutting through this dominant dynamic, especially in general elections, of negative partisanship, with the idea of open primaries?
I'll give you one example I write about in the book. I was talking to my dad leading up to the 2022 midterms. He still votes in Pennsylvania. This is the Fetterman-Oz race. And I asked him who he's going to vote for. And he says, I'm not voting. I said, what do you mean? You know what I do for work. How do you not vote? And he says, well, I thought I was skirting the argument, but in reality, he said, as an independent voter, I was not able to participate in either primary, and I don't like either of these candidates. And there are a lot of other people, you know, like my dad out there, who get to the November ballot and just scratch their heads. Where did these candidates come from? The partisan primary is optimized for the candidate that represents the median voter of the primary of either side, but that is very far from where the median voter is by the time you get to the general election. It's because primaries have half the turnout of general elections. Fewer people vote that early in the cycle or are paying attention, but as I mentioned before, a lot of people can't even cast a ballot. So that's how we wind up with a lot of elections that voters perceive as being the lesser of two evils. And all either of those candidates have to do is prove the other candidates more evil in order to win. And so this is what contributes to this sort of doom loop of polarization and negative partisanship that we see today. The promise of primary reform is not just being able to get more representative candidates out of both parties' primaries, but actually getting more candidates into the general election and breaking the binary that exists in our current zero-sum politics.
Yeah, I was happy to see, you mentioned doom loop, which reminded me of Lee Drutman's work, and I was happy to see some praise for the book from Lee. That was, yeah, it was really great. This election cycle in particular, there's been a lot of attention paid to the potential for spoiler candidates. We've been talking about RFK Jr. a lot. You may have different feelings about this, but the No Labels presidential bid, I thought was a terrible, terrible, either generously misguided or, you know, not so generously malicious attempt to throw the election to Trump. How does the plurality, thankfully they're not pursuing that anymore, but how does the plurality voting system create this spoiler system, this spoiler problem? Plurality voting, again, this is what you're probably most familiar with, is whoever gets the most votes of any candidate running for that office wins. You could get 35% of the vote, but as long as you have more votes than any other candidate, you win. Now contrast that with majority voting, where the winner actually has to win more than 50% of the votes cast. Majority voting is what ranked choice ballots enable.
In my view, the plurality system is why we believe groups like No Labels or candidates like RFK are the problem, instead of the fact that both parties have nominated candidates that most of the country do not want. Supporting democracy means supporting choice and meaningful choice for voters. So instead of casting the problem as those that are trying to offer more choice, the real problem is, why doesn't the system accommodate that? And it can't accommodate that because we have this perverse plurality election system where voting for the candidate that you prefer most introduces the risk you might wind up electing the candidate you like least. And I experienced this when I ran as an independent candidate for Congress, of people saying, Nick, I like you, but if I vote for you, I think it's going to wind up electing, you know, the D or the R. This is an entirely solvable problem. You know, Maine has actually solved this. Alaska has, including for the presidential election that's upcoming. By using a ranked ballot and an instant runoff, voters can express their true preference without worrying about spoiling the election. And I think that would be a healthy thing for our democracy.
Totally agree. Ranked choice voting and open primaries are my top two political reforms in terms of like the two biggest that I think would have an actual impact. Here's where this gets tricky. We can talk about, actually, we should define a plurality system right now. So what we mean by that is you don't have to win a majority in order to be elected. You can win an election with 40% of the vote, provided that you have the most votes in an election. We call that also first past the post voting. In ranked choice voting, the winner ultimately has to get more than 50% of the votes. They have to win a majority of the constituents' support, right? Here's where I think this gets tricky, because I agree with you on competition. If the plurality system, which is dominated by the two parties, ultimately is the reason we come to see new entrants into the competition like RFK Jr. and No Labels as the problem, the spoilers, which I agree, they shouldn't be. We should have as much competition as possible. Why then do you not make the leap to a multi-party democracy? Why not allow and break down barriers for more parties to organize and compete, as opposed to just opening it to more candidates?
I actually think those are one and the same in the sense that if we were to move to a top four primary ranked choice voting general election system in most states, it would provide the environment not only for more independent candidates to run and win, but also for new parties to form and organize. Why would you endeavor to create a new party right now when the election system itself so disadvantages the new competition? Which is why I think groups like Forward Party are smart, because they are not only advocating for a new type of candidate, but they are hand in hand advocating for a new type of election system.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I agree. You can't, the trouble is you can't do it quickly. It's a very, you have to build from the bottom up. And that's something that, you know, it's very difficult to raise money and build an operation with a 20-year horizon to accomplish what you say you're going to do rather than floating a candidate in the middle of a pluralistic system in a presidential election and get a whole bunch of attention, good and bad, right? It's a much trickier proposition. Okay. This is an interesting question. My dear friend, Mike Madrid, who's also a good friend of the podcast, we talk about this regularly, structural reform versus cultural change. And Mike Madrid often pushes back and argues that structural reform has to be downstream of cultural change for the same reason that politics is always only ever downstream from culture. That there needs to be a culture willing to accept the structural change, a culture that prioritizes healthier politics in order for those reforms to be effective. I tend to disagree. I think structural reforms can be enormously effective at steering the outcomes. By changing the rules, we can actually change. But I think he makes a really valid point that needs to be dealt with. Given the negative partisanship we've discussed, which applies to party brands in the same way that it applies to candidates, how are you thinking about that argument, about people's willingness to set aside the, you know, ultra high stakes intensity of every single election in order to prioritize the reforms we're talking about to create a healthier politics? Because it feels like at every fork in the road, at every opportunity to do this, it's a life or death situation, right? That's the level of heat that our politics currently has. So how do you get past that?
It requires a little multitasking.
Okay.
We have to put out the fire while you turn off the gas, right? At the same time. And I think it's a great question because I don't think one is upstream or downstream from another. I think it's a self-reinforcing cycle of structural incentives, cultural divisions, and technological change, all feeding each other in a way that is causing our society to really be frayed. And of all of those three major challenges I just described, the structural thing is something we can do something about tomorrow if we wanted. And we're going to get into how 2024 can be an inflection point, you know, for this election reform movement. Solving that does not mean solving everything overnight, but it does provide us a bit more time and space to do that, and hopefully gets the flywheel sort of spinning in the other direction. So if you think about it right now, with the system that we have, it is providing a fast track for the types of candidates that use the type of rhetoric that only further polarize the electorate, which then wind up electing more extreme. It is a vicious cycle, and we have to turn it into a virtuous one.
Okay. What are some of the options for electoral reform, both in primaries and in general elections, outside of open primaries?
If I can, let me zoom in on the variety of primary reform. So if we accept the premise that the current closed party primaries are the worst option for nominating competitive candidates and incentivizing leaders to produce results, what's on the table? 15 states have decided to open their primaries to independent voters, so independents can pick one party or another. 15 states don't have party voter registration, which means when you show up to the voting booth, any voter can vote in either party's primary. And then 5 states have done away with party primaries altogether. And within that group, you have a state like Louisiana, which literally just does not have a primary. You have Nebraska, California, and Washington that have a top 2 system, at least for state legislature. All candidates on one ballot, the top 2 finishers, regardless of party, go to the general election. And then you have Alaska with the first top 4 primary and an instant runoff general election. I would take any of those over any kind of party primary system, because what it enables a candidate to do is from day one campaign to the entire electorate without having to pass through sort of the eye of the needle on either side, in which only 8% of voters decide who gets through. And then that same calculation is present when they're in office and governing and considering a piece of legislation. They're thinking about their reelection prospects, not in terms of, will the 8% like this, but will a majority of my constituents like this? So abolishing partisan primaries is at the top of my list for what real reform looks like.
So in the reform space, then, how do you try to coordinate different groups pushing for, how do you judge each of these different methods on the merits and avoid having different groups with competing reforms at the same time, all ultimately trying to row in the same direction? Because once you get into the space, you recognize there are a lot of people with very strong views that there's only one right way to do this. And we lose sight of the fact that any of them would be better than the current options. So,
Ron, it drives me crazy. It is the narcissism of small differences. We have to step back and realize what is broken, the current system, and what is better. Pretty much anything that we can do to get us away from close primaries and plurality winners. There's a range of reforms and a range of impact. And guess what? There's also 50 states. It's called the laboratories of democracy. We should test and see what works. There is not a one-size-fits-all solution. And when thinking about building a social movement, like others in the past, of which election reform is today, we can take cues for how other movements have succeeded. I think about the marriage equality movement, for example. They sat down in 2005 to develop a strategic plan that part of it was called 10-10-10-20. In 10 states, it was primed for the full North Star of marriage equality. In 10 states, it was civil unions, right? In 10 states, it was non-discrimination. And in the other 20, we're just going to try and do whatever the best thing is that we can move the needle on. I view the election reform movement in the same way. I'd like to see as many states pursue the Alaska system as possible. But where that's not, what can we do to advance and make the system better for voters? In Pennsylvania right now, there's a bill, a bipartisan bill, to open the primaries to independents. That's a great step forward. And in Colorado, there's a ballot initiative for the Alaska-style policy. Let's go for it, right? That's a movement, and that's what we need if we're going to get away from what we know is true, which is that the current system is not serving us.
Yeah. Okay. It's a great segue. Let's talk about Alaska, because you write about it a lot in the book. Explain the way the electoral reforms that Alaska has enacted have impacted the way Alaskans vote. I did talk about this with Fair Vote, and they also mentioned the pushback, right? The backlash to these reforms in Alaska on a partisan basis. So maybe you can explain what's been going on there and what might happen this year.
Well, let's go back to 2019. When this was the year where an upstart group of Alaskans led by a gentleman named Scott Kendall decided to put a proposal forward. And what the proposal sought to do was address the problem that they saw playing out in their state legislature, which was that legislators who were working across the aisle, including to solve the state's fiscal imbalance, were being primaried out of office. And so they wanted to do something about that. And he looked around at the other systems, opening it as a top two, and ultimately landed on this top four proposal. And so the proposal did two things. It replaced the party primaries with an all-candidate primary. You vote for your favorite, the top four finishers advance. And because you have four candidates, regardless of party in the general election, and you want someone to win with a majority, not just a plurality, that is where the instant runoff comes from. And the instant runoff is a better alternative than what many states use, which is just a runoff election. If no one gets a majority, there's a whole nother election. So rather than that time and expense, if voters rank their preferences, the tabulation of majority winner can be done instantly. So that was the policy. They defended it in the Alaska Supreme Court, got it on the ballot, got a majority of voters to adopt it, and implemented it for the first time in 2022. And the results were quite stunning. Just to look at the statewide level, you know, you had a Senator Lisa Murkowski who was getting primary that was able to get to the general election. Otherwise wouldn't have happened without the top four primary.
Got rid of Kelly Chewbacca.
Right. You had a moderate Democrat and Mary Peltola who not only got to the general election, which she will tell you would not have happened in the old party primary system. You know, she defeated a far-right candidate, Sarah Palin. And you had the conservative Republican governor, Mike Dunleavy, get reelected with an outright majority of votes. So just on the surface level, you see that this reform enabled the Alaska electorate, a majority of whom are independents, to express their true preferences. It didn't benefit either party. It benefited candidates who represented the majority. There is one more Alaska story I would love to tell. Yeah. I think the most extraordinary thing that happened in Alaska in 2022 wasn't at the statewide level. It was in the state legislature, where the former Senate president, Kathy Geisel, was one of the legislators who was primaried out in 2020. She ran for re-election under this new system. And what she tells about that experience was that in her past elections, of which she won many of them, her safe Republican district was one in which all you had to do was target the likely Republican voters. And you know this, Ron, the party hands you a list of these are the folks whose ads you should target or whose doors you should knock on. This time around, she threw out that list and said, I'm just going to knock on every person's door. Imagine that concept, right? Of a candidate who wants to talk to everyone. And she did. And for in the general election, for folks that said, I'm supporting the Democrat or I'm supporting a Republican challenger, she said, fine, I would appreciate your second choice vote. And guess what happened in November? She won with a true majority support. Beyond that, she gets back into the state Senate and helps form a bipartisan governing coalition that put the four extremist Republicans to the side and the rest of the Democrats and Republicans caucus together to say, we're going to focus on the issues that most Alaskans sent us here to focus on. Kathy's story is why I think this reform can be so transformative for our politics.
Let's talk about the backlash that happened in Alaska, and probably we should air some of the most common objections to this reform, as well as some of the strongest and most credible objections, because they probably are not the same, right? Because I've heard a lot of stuff like, oh, voters won't understand it, it's too confusing, or, it's people aren't going to get it, which is really condescending. I don't think that it's not rooted in reality. But then there are some, legal objections as well. Like, parties have a First Amendment associational right. And so if you require them to open their association up to the influence of other people who aren't part of that party, you have a potential constitutional violation, right? So talk about the objections that you've seen, the good ones, the bad ones, the more credible, and how do you deal with those?
Let me start with a constitutional argument.
Yeah, great.
There used to be a voting system called a blanket primary where everyone could vote and the top Republican and top Democrat were to advance the general election. That was challenged in the United States Supreme Court precisely on the grounds that you said. How can you require a private organization to, open its primaries, its nominating process to voters of the other party? So it was struck down. And what Washington State ultimately came back with when it developed its top two nonpartisan primary was to say, well, this primary is not intended to nominate one standard bearer for either political party. It will just advance the top two finishers, regardless of party. When that was challenged in the Supreme Court, it was a conservative majority led by Justice Thomas that said, this withstands constitutional muster because parties do not have the right to control the labels that candidates may run on the ballot, although they can have their own separate nominating process. And so that Supreme Court decision in the early 2000s is what paved the way for the Alaska system to even be possible today. The other objections I've heard for the Alaska system really focuses on the ranked choice voting piece. And so it's important to remind listeners that the reform in Alaska isn't just ranked choice voting. There is a top four primary and ranked choice. You hardly hear criticism of the primary piece because it's extraordinarily popular among voters. The idea that every voter should be able to vote for any candidate in every election, good luck trying to take that away, right? Ranked choice voting is a bit more controversial because it's newer. I would say it's a bit more innovative, and it takes a minute to explain how it works. So opponents have said it is complicated and confusing or violates one person, one vote. But the truth is, what we've seen in jurisdictions across the country is when voters use it, they like it and they can use it well. And in Alaska, 99.9% of ballots were cast accurately under this system. No one was disenfranchised. And by the way, if you don't want to rank your candidates, you don't have to. You can still vote the old way. And you're no worse off than you were in the old system. The pushback that comes for the Alaska system is largely based on electoral outcomes. Republicans in particular will ask, how did a Democrat get elected if 60% of Republican voters ranked a Republican first? And the answer to that is because nearly half of Nick Begich's, who was the other candidate in that race, his voters did not want to vote for Sarah Palin second. And so the lesson should be, how do you run candidates that are more broadly appealing? How do you adapt to a new system that incentivizes majority support? And that's lost, I think, in this battle, what is really just over political power.
How do voters report feeling after a ranked choice voting election? Do we have data that shows people actually really do get this? They think it's a better way of participating in elections. Do we have some positive reinforcement that happens afterward? Or what does the survey research show about voter attitudes about these systems after they've participated?
You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee, and you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, sneakers and streetwear so fresh, every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
This episode is brought to you by Terminix. Terminix can't help you solve the world's biggest mysteries or take on alien life, at least not the ones you're thinking of, but they can help take care of pesky invaders in your home, like the ants in your kitchen, the roaches under your sink, and the termites in the walls. Because when pests show up, so does Terminix. No matter what type of bug it is, they can Terminix it fast with personalized pest care that puts you in control. And with over 95 years of experience, it's no wonder they're trusted by homes and businesses everywhere. So if you have a pest problem, don't stress it. Terminix it. Visit Terminix.com to book your appointment online today. That's TERMINIX.com.
This episode is brought to you by Vonage. With Vonage Video API, your developers can easily create custom video experiences tailored to your business. Enhance every conversation with live video, whether it's delivering faster tech support, improving customer service, or enabling interactive meetings and events. Unlock the true video potential of your business. Discover how at Vonage.com.
At United America, we've taken this question seriously because we care about increasing trust and participation and confidence in elections. And the exit polling that we've commissioned has consistently shown 80%+ of voters will describe the new system as simple. And that is in its first instance. You know, imagine if you go back to the founding and we designed the system with a ranked ballot to begin with, right? No one would be saying, oh, it's confusing. We would have lived under it. And if politicians had proposed, actually, we're going to take your power away and you can only vote for one candidate, there would be an outrage, right? So it takes some getting used to, but the initial results show that voters who use it can navigate it and like it.
Okay, outside of Alaska, we had a listener write in a little while ago, shout out to Stephen W., to ask us about Alabama's push to ban ranked choice voting. There are obviously other places in the country besides Alaska where we're seeing this backlash. Is it always driven by parties and partisans? And where are you? I want to talk about the path forward, but I want to also understand, like, how fierce is the opposition to this by the parties? My understanding was that the campaign to get rid of ranked choice voting in Alaska was actually getting a lot more intense as of last year. So, how big a fight is this, you know, shaping up to be?
Opposition to ranked choice voting has sort of entered the bloodstream on the far right, and in many places, the far left that has opposed it as well, which we're seeing in Nevada in real time. They will say different things, but they really mean the same thing, which is this might erode my power.
Right.
That I currently have. Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And so we have seen some bans of ranked choice voting, curiously, in states that don't have ranked choice voting. This is more of a, you know, public preemptive statement, I suppose, which can always be changed, including through the ballot initiative process. But we've also seen states defend the systems they have. Republicans tried to ban it in Georgia and lost. They tried to repeal it in Utah and lost, in Virginia and lost, with Republicans standing up and saying, actually, you know, this makes sense. It's a better, faster, cheaper way of running elections. The narrative, of course, is a bit different. And it's largely, again, influenced by a small number of data points of some elections. But I do think once more elections are run under the system and Republicans realize, actually, it can help them field more competitive candidates, or actually it can deal with the spoiler problem of why libertarians have caused Republicans to lose some races, they may change their mind. And we have seen that on issues like vote by mail as well. Yeah. Demagogued in one cycle, and I think the party coming around to realizing we don't like losing elections, so we should reconsider our position on this.
Okay, let's talk about the path forward. Where are the places in the country that seem to show the most promise? What states, what ballot initiatives, what candidates, what do you have your eye on this cycle? And where can people, this is tricky because you don't always know which groups to give to and how they're going to be effective with the money. And there's with so many different players in this space, it's hard to know who's doing what. First talk about the landscape, and then maybe we can talk about what people can do to help support this movement.
Before I lose the thread on the latter point, that was a great 15-second advertisement for United America, because we've built a model of being a philanthropic venture fund to solve for the fact that the barrier to entry is quite high for donors who want to know how their dollars can be most effective. So our organization does the diligence, makes the grants, and it includes a lot of hands-on and in-kind strategic support to help optimize our investments for policy victories. Because as much as this is an academic exercise, it's not for us. This is about winning policy, improving the voting system, and changing outcomes in Congress. And over the next 3 years, our goal is to abolish party primaries in six more states by the country's 250th birthday. So basically six more Alaskas. Why? That would essentially liberate a dozen more U.S. senators and dozens of more representatives who can actually govern in the public interest. And as you know, it doesn't take many in a narrowly divided Congress that can actually force the kind of compromise and common ground to address some big issues. So it is a high return on investment if you're looking at a political system and saying, why doesn't my issue get solved? Well, we don't have a functional representative government. If we fix that, we can make progress on a lot of other things. Why this year is such a big deal is because there are currently six states pursuing ballot initiatives for some type of primary reform. That includes in Nevada, where they were successful in 2022. And a unique dynamic of that state is it actually has to pass twice to change the state's constitution. So that's one. And Idaho, where just this week, volunteers turned in 95,000 signatures, all volunteer collected, to put this on the ballot in Idaho. And other states, including Colorado, Montana, South Dakota, and Arizona, are trying to qualify, as we speak, initiatives to give voters this choice. So the pathway for big primary reform change in the near term is through the ballot initiative process, because you can go around the state legislatures and put it directly to a vote. And these ideas are broadly popular. The idea of everyone should be able to vote for anyone and whoever wins should have a majority. 80%+ of Democrats, Republicans, and independents agree on that. The challenge is when that issue gets polarized. If one party is out there saying this is really a backdoor way of electing the others. And Democrats are doing that in Nevada. You know, Republicans are doing that in Montana. But this is the fight. And I ultimately think the people will prevail. We have in the past. It goes back to the whole story of how we got primaries to begin with. The people have this power. In the other set of states, half the states that don't have the ballot initiative process, it's more incremental over the next few years. It's like a Pennsylvania opening primaries to independents, or a Georgia replacing its runoff with an instant runoff system. And as a whole, I think we're going to see a sort of renaissance of election reform at a time when the country so desperately needs it.
I sure hope so. I want to go back to the ballot reform states, because one thing that we've seen pop up over and over again, not just with reforms, but with hot button policy issues, is that voters will oftentimes approve a ballot initiative by a really astounding margin. And then it goes to the legislature, and a lot of states' legislatures have the authority to overturn ballot initiatives if they don't like them, right? If the referendum succeeds and the legislature doesn't like it, they'll just turn it over, which takes that authority away from the voters, and then they have to do it all over again, or sometimes they don't have the option of doing it over again. So how concerned are you that that's going to happen with some of these reforms in the ballot initiative states?
It could have happened in Alaska, but it didn't in the next legislative session, in part because the new folks that got elected under the new system happened to be people who saw the benefit, you know, of it. And so there is a period of time post-passage where it's a bit dicey when you still have a lot of people elected under the old system trying to take their power back. But as time goes on and a new crop of candidates run for office, including those who didn't have a pathway in the old system, get elected, I think there's a more secure pathway of keeping it sustainable. The other answer is that in some states, you can amend the state's constitution, not just pass a statute. So it's much harder for the legislature to undo the will of the people.
Now let's have a daydream. Yesterday, my producer and I were, having a blue sky conversation about a top four presidential primary or ranked choice voting in presidential elections. What would that dream look like to you? And if you see a realistic path to getting there over the next, you know, X number of years, fill in the number, what does it look like?
I love that dream. I don't address it in the book, in part because I think it is a bit further down the path. I do think presidential primary should be open to independent voters. Presidential primary should use instant runoffs. I do think, though, that the culture of the country has been so conditioned to you have a Republican candidate, a Democratic candidate. I'd like to see us, you know, have ranked choice in the general election and be able to see more candidates. I don't know how realistic it is in the near term to imagine getting rid of the primary system altogether. However, there's good model. We are the only country in the world that elects our president this way. The two-round system that countries like France uses is very attractive. The parties have their own process to nominate who their candidate should be, and then all of those candidates participate in round one, and the top two finishers then go to a runoff a few weeks later. And it's no surprise that while America was over here electing Donald Trump, who didn't win a majority of Republicans, no less a majority of all voters, Marie Le Pen, who was running, was defeated, and an independent, Emmanuel Macron, winds up running and getting elected. It is entirely a story about electoral systems and the difference between these two countries. So does the two-round system become viable here one day? Maybe. And the way of doing that is introducing the concept of an all-candidate primary to voters in America. And that's the intent of doing this at the state level.
On a state-by-state basis, the laboratories of democracy will prove the concept and that it will trickle up.
Yes.
Okay.
This episode is sponsored by Tire Rack. Since 1979, TireRack.com has been helping people find the right tires for how, what, and where they drive. They sell only the best, like the full line of Falcon tires. Test results, ratings, and reviews are there to assist. Or try the Tire Decision Guide to get a personalized tire recommendation. Tires ship fast and free to you or to one of over 10,000 recommended installers. In many areas, they offer mobile tire installation that comes to your home or office. Shop Falcon Tires at TireRack.com.
The founder of Panasonic once said,
"We can lead more meaningful and constructive lives
through the pursuit of activities that will ensure
a better today than yesterday,
a better tomorrow than today."
Panasonic is committed to creating a greener,
more equitable future
for everyone.
Explore Panasonic Green Impact
at na.panasonic.com/greenimpact.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Nick, what have I not asked you that you would like to be asked? I know you're doing a lot of these interviews. What never comes up that you wish would come up?
Maybe just what makes me optimistic in this moment. I mean, we are in the throes of what could be the most divisive presidential election in our lifetime, with threats to democracy quite high. And what gives me hope is the Americans that are coming together across lines of difference at the local and state level to do something about that. And it's not about defeating one candidate or another this November. It's about reimagining the way that we do democracy in America. We can't take for granted the system that we have, right? Self-governance in a democratic system is an aberration in all of human history. What we have is made special by the inheritance of a constitution, passed down to us, that it is our right and obligation to protect for future generations as well. There is nothing so wrong with the current system that doesn't also give us the tools to fix. I learned that when I ran for office and got my name on the ballot as an independent candidate at age 25, and I experience that every day. We have the tools. And so we can't give up. If people who are in the fight exit, it's only going to create a vacuum for those that are going to further polarize the country. And so whether it's the volunteers in Idaho or the business leaders that are coming together to help mobilize resources into this movement, Americans are standing up for something that's much bigger than any individual politician or party, but it's really the idea of America itself.
Well said. Okay, before I let you go, where can everybody find your work on the internet? Where do you want to point people to? Where's the best place to buy the book, by the way?
I think the right answer is wherever books are sold. Okay. It's called The Primary Solution.
Okay.
And available hardcover, audiobook. The website's uniteamerica.org. And I'm Nick Traiano on social media. And people can get involved with our organization if they're looking to put resources to use in this movement, or visit our website. And there's a couple dozen partner organizations we're working with all around the country and state campaigns they can get involved with right in their own backyard.
Fantastic. Okay, let's wrap there. Congratulations and Godspeed.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. If you haven't yet, we'd appreciate it if you could open up the Apple Podcasts app and give us a 5-star rating and review over there. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even when we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.